The Tom Woods Show, episode 497.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you're interested in more libertarian podcasts, let me recommend to you the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, he gives you a libertarian look at the news. Check him out at jasonstapleton.com. Welcome to episode 497. Today, as you can tell from the episode title, I'm going to be taking on an article that appeared in Fortune magazine that was directed entirely at me. There was a whole article in Fortune about me. And it's not the most hostile criticism I've ever received, certainly. If only all the criticisms could be like this, I'd feel a lot better. But all the same, it is a criticism. It's a criticism of my book, The Church and the Market. Obviously, with Pope Francis in the United States, these sorts of issues are on the front burner now. So the author, who was Chris Matthews, not the guy on MSNBC, that would have made it a lot more interesting, is implying, or maybe not implying, coming right out and saying that my project in that book is really implausible. So I'm going to tell you about my project in that book, and we're going to talk about the free market and the Austrian school, which are sort of attacked, let's say, in this article, and I want to defend those good things. Before I do that, I want to tell you that I am giving away, I give away free ebooks all the time, but now I'm taking one of the books you normally have to pay for, and I'm giving that away. So let me just let you know about that before I get into this article. I've been promoting for nearly a year now my book Real Dissent, and the subtitle is A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And for a while, I've been giving that as a freebie, as one of the 8 gazillion freebies I give away for people who support the show at supportinglisteners.com. The private Facebook group is another one of those perks. Well, for a few days only, I'm extending that to everyone in the world. Everyone in the world can get the Kindle version of Real Dissent for nothing. So if you go to Amazon, you type in Real Dissent, and you look at the Kindle version, you'll see the price is zero. That's not a misprint. You go grab that. It costs you nothing. So go get it. Now there's no reason not to get it. You'll really enjoy it. And remember, obviously, if you've been listening to this show, the point is that you'll enjoy it. Maybe you wouldn't enjoy it if you don't like the show. But remember also, you can get the audio version of it with me reading it for free through TomWoodsAudio.com. But certainly grab the Kindle version for free, because it's only going to be free for a few days. So, and you're going to forget about it. So do it right now. I don't earn a thing. So I'm just telling you to get it because I think you'll like it and because I would like my work to be spread around. But I'm not secretly selling you something. There's no secret attempt to siphon money from you. There's no money involved. It's really free. All right, let's turn now to this article. It's called Can Catholics Love Their Faith and the Free Market? And I will link to it at tomwoods.com/497. I'm going to link to a whole bunch of things on that page. Of course, I will link to my book, The Church and the Market. I'm going to link to at least one other book, link to an article or two. I'm going to link to a video by Jeff Herbener. So I'm going to link to Ryan McMakin's response to this article over on the Mises blog. So tomwoods.com/497. is going to be a lot of fun to visit, and you're going to be kicking yourself if you don't. So definitely check that out. Let me remind you of what the thesis of my book, The Church and the Market, is. That book came out in 2005, and it just came out in a 10th anniversary edition with a brand new chapter and a new foreword, a new introduction to the 10th anniversary edition. And the cover is much nicer, and we have a lot more blurbs on the back, and more prestigious institutions and individuals are blurbing it, and it's wonderful. I couldn't be happier about how it looks, how it's packaged. And I actually think The Church and the Market may be the best book I've ever written, even though it's not the most popular. I think it's the best book because it's the most original contribution I've ever made to libertarianism or to Austrian economics, by a long shot. So I think you would enjoy it. It's not a book that it's not something, if you're not a Catholic, you can't possibly learn from it. It really is an introduction to Austrian economics that goes beyond what you would learn about general economics in Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. It takes you step by step, takes you through praxeology, it takes you through the derivation of the law of marginal utility, and then it goes on through prices and wage rates and monopoly theory and economic calculation and socialism and the welfare state and foreign aid, which is not specifically an Austrian concern, but you can bring some Austrian insights to bear on it, no doubt. A whole lot of topics, like you name it, banking, the business cycle, money, inflation, interest, all that stuff is all covered in there in the Church and the Market. So linking to that on the show notes page. And the basic gist of it is that obviously a Catholic is perfectly at liberty to believe all these things, to believe in the whole, all the observations of the Austrian school. The Austrian school is simply telling you how the world works. So it's not morally right or morally wrong that artificially lowering interest rates kicks the business cycle into motion. That's not something you can protest or be angry about. That's a fact. That's just the way it is. That's the way the world works. Or that if you raise the minimum wage to $50 an hour, you're going to have fewer people employed. Well, that's not something you can hold a candlelight vigil to protest. You can't shake your fist at it. That's just a fact of the way the world works. So the point of the book is that it's one thing for somebody to say, hey, the family is really important. We got to do what we can to bolster the family. That's all well and good. You know, no civilized person is going to disagree with that. But if you then go on to say, now, here are my practical suggestions for that. First, we need a living wage for everybody, and then we need maximum hours legislation, and then we need, well, now you're way beyond recommending just general principles, and now you're recommending things that you would need a specialized knowledge of a particular discipline, namely economics, to be able to evaluate. Because there's nobody, obviously no church official would have any particular insight into that. They might have some moral insight into some questions, you know, be honest in your dealings and live up to your contractual obligations and so on and so forth. That's fine. But in the same way that we could understand that somebody might say a church should be built to last for the long haul, but then couldn't really say, now, here's how to do that. First, you have to have this much concrete and the foundation needs to be. Obviously, again, we would see immediately, well, that's just the person speaking in his own private capacity. Obviously, nobody becomes an expert in architecture just because he becomes a bishop or a priest or whatever. So that's the point there. And by the way, it's not unique to church officials to make errors in economics, as they obviously have. I mean, you look at the bishop's statements on economics in the United States, it's just an embarrassment, total embarrassment. It's like they're trying to keep people poor. But let's remember, even the economists are pretty bad at economics these days. Even the economists, some of them, are calling for dramatic increases in the minimum wage. And to justify that, they're citing these studies, which are questionable on a number of grounds, as we've talked about on the show, but not one of those studies has ever dealt with a more than 100% increase in the minimum wage. Not one of those studies. We talk about that, by the way, in my free ebook on Bernie Sanders, which you can get at BernieIsWrong.com. Or you can get by texting the name Bernie to 33444. But my point is, we shouldn't be excessively harsh on churchmen when economists themselves are lousy on economics. That's my point. All right, let's go through the article now. The author, this Chris Matthews, is saying that the Pope is really not saying much new when he speaks on economics, that really he's just saying what all the other popes before him have said. Well, that's true and not true. I would say Francis is much more anti-market than previous popes. I can find some popes who are much friendlier to the market. Pope Pius XII would be a good example of that. Even Pope John Paul II, who's kind of hard to pin down on these issues, was more friendly to the market. You see that in his encyclical Centesimus Annus. And I'll say more about John Paul in a minute. But when I look back, for example, to Leo XIII, what do I find? Leo XIII is thought to be the person who really gets the corpus of Catholic social teaching underway, particularly with his work Rerum Novarum of 1891. But Pope Leo XIII says that private property rights are, quote, sacred and inviolable, unquote. So it doesn't really matter what you say about capitalism. If that's your view on private property, then that pretty much settles a whole lot of questions. And it's funny to see Catholics on the left who, by the way, I don't know what they're doing in the Catholic Church. If you look through 2,000 years of Catholic history, you find a lot of things. You do not find leftism. You find absolutely no support for any aspect of leftism whatsoever. So what these people are doing in the church in the first place, I never quite got. But all the same, it's funny to see Catholics on the left, all they've tried to do over the years to try to explain away what Leo XIII said about private property rights being sacred and inviolable. Oh my gosh, that is the phrase that drives them the craziest. But there it is. There he is saying it. And yes, it's true that, and I talk about this in the Church of the Market, I can find some disparaging references to the market system and to economic competition and so on in Leo XIII, and especially in Pius XI. But all right, well, why are they criticizing these things? Because they think, for some reason, that these institutions are harming the poor. But surely Leo XIII should have had access to basic demographic data and data showing population trends and life expectancy trends, which were all up for every group. They were all way, way up for every group. And of course, as the 20th century went on, the condition of the poorest just absolutely skyrocketed to levels never been seen before in the history of the world. And I talked about this a little bit in the episode with Deirdre McCloskey, so I'll link to McCloskey episode, writing this down. Because she points out, of course, that you've got $3 a day as the average global per capita income in the early 19th century. And that today it's up to $33 a day. And if you just focus on the countries that, you know, have sensible institutions, you're talking about $100 a day. That's an astonishing increase. And it was made possible by the market economy. So nothing else made that possible. The welfare states of the world obviously are not engaging in enough transfers for that type of wealth increase to be possible. But also, a lot of this growth is occurring before there was a welfare state. So if you have statements in papal documents saying that things have gotten worse, when in fact your own eyes tell you things have gotten better, well, again, obviously they're talking out of turn. They're talking on things that really they're just, they have no particular authority to be speaking on, and they would have to be informed like anybody else by reading economic statistics and being familiar with the real circumstances of the world. Williams goes on to say, and during the Great Depression, Pope Pius, meaning Pope Pius XI, advocated for workers' rights and fair wages. And then he just leaves it there. Well, all right, but these terms need to be defined. You can't just throw them out there. Like, everybody knows what workers' rights are, and everybody knows what fair wages are. Well, says who? What rights do you mean? Leo XIII is very often pointed to as a pope who really stood up for labor unions. But read closely what he said about them. And I can't remember if I put this in the Church and the Market or in one of my other writings, but he says that, of course, workers have a natural right to organize for purposes of negotiation. Nobody denies that. Of course they have the natural right to organize if they want. But then he goes on to say, and as long as everybody is allowed to accept whatever job he wants to accept, then labor unions are fine. Well, okay, that's the provision that everybody who blabs and blabs about Catholic social teaching totally forgets. Because he totally undermines all modern labor unions in that one line. Because the whole point of the modern labor union is to prevent people from taking jobs that they want to take. Because the wages aren't high enough, so you're a scab if you take it. We're not going to let you do it. So in other words, there is the use of violence. And Leo XIII is saying, no violence. As long as there's no violence and everybody can take whatever job he wants, then labor unions are fine. Okay, so in other words, as long as labor unions behave in a libertarian way, then labor unions are fine. Well, no argument there. So in terms of workers' rights, I'm the one siding with Leo XIII. And then in terms of fair wages, well, what's fair? How do we know what's fair? What's a non-arbitrary way of deciding what's fair? What we do know is that wage rates have consistently risen since the development of modern capitalism. There's no question about that. Now, today, there's some argument about whether wages have risen, but we talked to Don Boudreau about that. And he says, when you consider what a substantial factor fringe benefits are in modern compensation packages, when you factor that in, we continue to see growth in these things. And just ask yourself, yeah, it's true that in the 1950s, you had a situation where the mother could stay home and you had needed only one income and wasn't that great. But any American family could have the standard of living of the 1950s with one earner today. You could. And you'd have no computer, no cell phone, no TV, no telephone, no refrigerator, because that's what we see on The Honeymooners in the 1950s, which is a standard TV show. And Ralph Cramden's family had none of those things, not one of those things. They had an extremely sparsely furnished apartment with two rooms in it, and that was it. Anybody could have that with one income today. No one wants it. Then Williams goes on to say, the fact that U.S. Catholics are increasingly voting Republican suggests that many don't agree with the church's general predisposition towards social spending and foreign aid. Okay, but again, general predisposition, how could we possibly be dealing with dogmatic statements here? And that's the fuzziness of the so-called social teaching. A general predisposition towards something? Well, Catholics don't have a general predisposition against abortion. They don't have a general predisposition toward thinking of God as a Trinity. So to say there's a general predisposition right away shows we're obviously dealing with something qualitatively different here. And to elaborate on that, I'm going to link on at tomwoods.com/497 to a very provocative article by my friend John Zmirak, who's a Catholic writer, who wrote an article called The Myth of Catholic Social Teaching. And he says that when you go through the decades and the centuries, you see that the so-called social magisterium is extremely fluid, and we have completely different views being advocated at one time as opposed to another. Whereas when it comes to the Trinity, we got basically the same view over the centuries. So this whole social magisterium thing seems awfully slippery. So he's got a very, very interesting article on that. So tomwoods.com/497. All right. Well, anyway, I do want to read one little passage, though, from Pope John Paul II from Centesimus Annus, where he talks about the welfare state. He calls it the social assistance state. He says, malfunctions and defects in the social assistance state are the result of an inadequate understanding of the tasks proper to the state. Here again, the principle of subsidiarity must be respected. A community of a higher order should not interfere in the internal life of a community of a lower order, depriving the latter of its functions, but rather should support it in case of need and help to coordinate its activity with the activities of the rest of society, always with a view to the common good. By intervening directly and depriving society of its responsibility, the social assistance state leads to a loss of human energies and an inordinate increase of public agencies, which are dominated more by bureaucratic thinking than by concern for serving their clients, and which are accompanied by an enormous increase in spending. In fact, it would appear that needs are best understood and satisfied by people who are closest to them, who act as neighbors to those in need. It should be added that certain kinds of demands often call for a response which is not simply material, but which is capable of perceiving the deeper human need. All right, so is that a general predisposition towards social spending? This seems to be more of a concern about excessive social spending. So again, you see, how do we pin this down? How do we know which view is the one that all Catholics are supposed to hold? These are obviously debatable propositions. I quoted Archbishop John J. Myers of Newark, New Jersey, as saying that on the one hand, you have some Catholics who think that helping the poor means increasing social spending. On the other hand, you have Catholics who think that lowering the tax burden and lowering social spending it creates economic growth and that helps the poor. And the Archbishop said, well, you know, obviously Catholics can debate among themselves like anybody else over this. As long as we understand that we do want to help the poor, we can debate among ourselves how that ought to be done. Exactly. Exactly what I'm saying. That's the big controversial Tom Woods. That's exactly what I am saying. Now, as for foreign aid, well, I sure hope people aren't going to listen to the popes on this, because they are speaking out of turn. Primarily Pope Paul VI. He was speaking out of turn when he wrote Populorum Progressio in 1967. That document was an absolute disaster in what it recommended. Everything it recommended has been a disaster, as people like Peter Bauer tried to warn at the time. And I've already talked about this. I'll link to an article on this, on foreign aid, on what was recommended in that document. And there were just factual errors in that document, just outright factual errors. The Pope was giving voice to what was called the Singer-Prebisch thesis, which argued that there was a secular deterioration in the terms of trade facing third world countries. The third world countries tend to produce basic raw commodities, whereas the developed world produces finished manufactured goods, and supposedly the prices of raw commodities were suffering as compared to the finished manufactured goods, and so this was going to hurt the countries of the third world. This was not true. There was no evidence for this. And economists later on, and even at the time, said, well, there's nothing to this. This is false. And so for the Pope to say, well, we got to keep an eye on this, we have to keep an eye on what? It doesn't even exist. So he invites contempt by talking about things that really, in that encyclical in 1967, he was really just giving, like Pope Francis, was just speaking in terms that don't even sound Christian or Catholic at all. They just sound like they are reflecting fashionable, a widespread establishment opinion of that time. And every one of these development aid programs, Western-funded development aid, state-led development aid programs, was a disaster. The countries got poorer, terrible policies were entrenched, and the countries that emerged from poverty were the ones that established private property rights, respect for contract, the rule of law, reasonable legal systems, and so on. This is not brain surgery. And I refuse to go on believing that this is a matter of, well, people just don't know any better, and you know they have good intentions. But you know, your good intentions don't mean a thing. They just don't. If you're going to go and speak about things you know nothing about, and that are going to damage the lives of countless people. Who knows how many thousands, tens of thousands of people, where their lives were ruined because of these policies for reasons that I explain in the article I'll link to at tomwoods.com/497. I have a whole chapter on foreign aid in the church and the market. This is a black mark on the papacy that they would that the Pope would recommend policies like this. And also he was kind of suggesting that international trade is not going to help. The countries that have most embraced international trade are the ones that have grown the richest. Whereas those parts of the world, a lot of indigenous peoples that have isolated themselves from trade, are by far the poorest. Again, this is not brain surgery. This isn't a matter of, well, how could he have known? No, sorry, I don't accept that. Then Williams goes on to say, so how can the 48% of Catholic American voters who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012 justify their support for the candidate's economic policies? Well, as Ryan McMakin points out at Mises.org, since when has Mitt Romney been a budget cutter, right? I mean, unless you're just going to assume, well, Republicans favor the free market and low spending and not actually bother to look, the guy increases spending. Everywhere he turns, he increases spending. He favored an increase in the minimum wage. He has no consistent economic policy. It's a series of ad hoc judgments. There is no consistent economic theory behind. There's no theory of any kind behind Mitt Romney, for heaven's sake. I actually have to point this out to somebody? But if Romney really were what Williams thinks he was, then of course Catholics should vote for that kind of economic policy. Leaving aside the foreign policy, let's suppose we were dealing only with economic policy and Mitt Romney had really been an Austrian or a libertarian. Then of course a Catholic should support that, because that is what lifts people out of poverty, is the reinvestment of profits by businesses into the business to develop the business, to buy capital equipment, which leads to greater labor productivity, which leads to greater output of goods, which puts downward pressure on prices relative to wages and makes everybody's real income increase. Yes, that is what we want. Yes, and we know we don't want to tax that process, because then we're just taxing the process that increases the general standard of living. So, yes, it's true that there are popes who say, and bishops who say, we need more spending or we need higher wage rates or whatever to make people better off. But they're saying those things, they're saying to make people better off. But what if those things don't make people better off? That's the thing. We never even get an analysis of this. What if they don't? It's just taken for granted that these things make people better off. But what if they don't? We don't even get an analysis of that. And it's these unasked questions that I'm dealing with in the church and the market. All right, we're going to pause for just a minute to thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody, I know you like listening to podcasts and to libertarian ones in particular. Well, I'm very glad to recommend to you the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. He runs Monday through Friday as well at jasonstapleton.com, and he has a 10-episode challenge. So that's 2 weeks. If you'll listen for 2 weeks, you'll walk away better informed, more knowledgeable, and better equipped to challenge both progressives and conservatives. No more being silent when the subjects of politics or economics come up. You'll know how to articulate what you believe with confidence. Jason's goal is to teach the value of individual liberty and economic freedom through current events. And so for a full hour, 5 days a week, Jason will cover the current political and economic news from a libertarian perspective. Jason was recently picked up by the USA Radio Network, making him one of the only nationally syndicated libertarian radio show hosts in America. So check out the Jason Stapleton program at jasonstapleton.com. All right, anyway, he then gets to the Austrian school, which he describes as a heterodox school, that it's even more suspicious of government intervention than Milton Friedman is. All right, well, he gets that. Then he says that the Austrian point of view rejects evidence-based economics. Evidence-based economics, how about that? That relies on natural experiments and is instead in favor of principles derived by reason and logic. He makes it sound like that's a bad thing. Yeah, reason and logic. And so then he goes on to speak about my faith in Austrian principles. So, of course, it has to be faith. It can't be anything grounded in anything other than that because I'm not doing experiments. Well, how does he propose to do an experiment in economics when you're dealing with human beings with free will? You're not dealing with inanimate projectiles. How do you propose to do that? And how do you propose to decide whether the society that you're examining is wealthy because of socialism or in spite of socialism? All the so-called experiments you run and all the data that you gather can't tell you that. Is it rich because of or in spite of the socialism? These are the sorts of questions that you need theory for, because just looking at numbers can't give you the answer. Looking at numbers can't tell you causation as opposed to mere correlation. How can you know? You can't run experiments. That's the whole point. You can't isolate just one factor, like a rise in the minimum wage, and keep everything else constant and then see what happens. You can't do that. There are a million things going on that could obscure what would be happening if you had purely just a rise in the minimum wage. And so this is why Mises, Ludwig von Mises, wrote these treatises on epistemology in economics, how we know economic facts, we know economic truths, how we know economic laws. How do we know these things? As Aristotle said many, many years ago, 2,400 years ago, as Aristotle said, you have to apply to each discipline the method that is appropriate to that discipline. So we wouldn't say, for instance, or it would seem silly to say, well, Euclid rejects evidence-based geometry. Well, okay, so you really say we really have no evidence for the Pythagorean theorem? I mean, well, no evidence in the sense of gathering data and measuring triangles. But we wouldn't say, boy, that Euclid, what a moron. I mean, he didn't even measure any triangles, and he dares to tell us that there's some relationship between the side lengths of a right triangle? Who is this dogmatic idiot? You know, we wouldn't say that. He is engaged in the method that is appropriate to geometry. So simply to assume that the method that's appropriate to economics is the method that's appropriate to physics doesn't really answer the Austrian objections. I mean, we're trying to deal with these assumptions, which we believe to be faulty. Now, then he says that my faith in Austrian principles, which he misspells. He spells it P-R-I-N-C-I-P-A-L-S. Yikes, I don't know how the editor missed that one or how he missed that one. But my faith in Austrian principles leads me to reject almost any kind of government intervention. Yeah, almost. You can take that out. Any kind of government intervention as harmful to the very people, the working class and the poor, that is often aimed at helping. He says, Woods takes aim at classic conservative targets like rent control and minimum wage laws, which he argues end up hurting the most vulnerable by reducing the total amount of affordable housing and killing jobs. Well, he makes it sound like this is some weird, fringy view, But that's basically the standard view of all economists. I mean, recently we've got a little bit of dissent on the minimum wage, but by and large, those are totally mainstream positions, nothing uniquely Austrian about them. So I will go ahead and insert a controversial position, because being against rent control and the minimum wage is not controversial in economics. So I'll supply him with one. Why not? I'm a sport. Let's take maximum hours legislation, because that seems harmless enough. We don't want people working too long, so we will have maximum hours legislation. Well, who could possibly be against that? Well, I want to think through the logic of this here. Think about you yourself today. Think about you and the number of hours that you work. Now, you, no matter how much you work, any of you listening to this show right now, could be working more, right? It's conceivable. You could get a second job, a third job. You could work an extra 2 hours a week as a tutor, whatever. Doesn't have to be an extra full-time job, but you could be working more. You could. You'd earn more money. Why aren't you doing it? Because you value the leisure. Because you've gotten to a point, and society and the economy have gotten to a point, where we are physically productive enough that we can produce enough goods that you would be physically satisfied after, let's say, a 40 or 50 hour week. You'd be satisfied, such that although you know you could work more, you'd rather have the leisure. You have enough comfort physically that you'd rather just enjoy the leisure. Well, that's good that we've gotten to that point, but we haven't always been at that point. Now think, what if I said that we've suddenly decided that a 40 hour week is just inhuman? It's too much. You should work 30 hours, and we impose on you a limit. We have a law saying you can't work more than 30 hours a week. Now, you chose to work 40 hours a week. I mean, you could have found a combination of jobs that would have added up to 30. You chose 40. That's the job you took. But if I now pass a law saying you can work only 30, have I made you better off? Well, given that you've already balanced your preference for leisure with your preference for work, and you don't want to work 100 hours a week, let's say. You'd rather have the leisure. But you don't want to work 10 hours a week because you'd rather have the money. If I just say you have to work 30 hours a week, I'm just depriving you of money that you could have earned. I mean, yes, I'm giving you leisure. But you'd rather have the money than that amount of leisure. And that's the problem with maximum hours legislation. Eventually, the society gets wealthy enough that people are content to work, you know, let's say they were working 80 hours a week. Well, they're content to work 60 when the society is wealthy enough that they have the purchasing power with their wages to buy enough stuff to satisfy them. Then they'll be happy to work for 60 hours a week. And at that point, if they're willing to accept, you know, 3/4 the compensation or slightly less than 3/4 the compensation, then any employer in his own self-interest will employ the person for just 60 hours a week. And then the process continues as the economy becomes wealthier, and the person's purchasing power expands. He'll want to work maybe just 50 hours a week. He'll want to have the leisure. But until the society and the economy get wealthy enough, he wants the money. He wants the money. So just simply saying, we're going to have you work fewer hours, does not automatically mean you're helping the person. Maybe the person is so desperately poor, he'd rather work almost constantly than deal with abject poverty. So even that apparently benign government intervention does not help. He then gets back to social spending and says that I'm opposed to the welfare state, that I describe it as an assault on the extended family, that the welfare state subsidizes the breakup and dispersal of extended family units. I don't think that's controversial. He says that he says that the welfare state isn't effective at alleviating poverty. I think that's not debatable, given that poverty has pretty much stayed at the same level since the welfare state really got going in the U.S., and discourages institutions like marriage and values like hard work that would lift up the less fortunate. Well, again, I don't think that's debatable. It subsidizes the opposite of those things. And I've cited Charles Murray's work on all this, and I talk about that. Probably I talk about that in the welfare state chapter. I must. Of the church and the market. So I do go into that at greater length, and I defend those positions. And then he says, Woods' ideas are fairly similar to those of Republican hardliners like Paul Ryan. Are you kidding me? Paul Ryan looks like Barack Obama compared to me. So anyway, but he goes on to say, in the end, much of what Woods argues is hard to square with the Christian faith's approach to charity. Well, okay, if he can quote me one verse in the Bible that calls for a welfare state, I'll change my mind, at least on whether or not Christianity is compatible with what I'm saying. I don't see one verse that calls for that. I see a lot of talk about helping the poor and this and that and rich people and so on and so forth. I don't see anything that calls for a welfare state. And it's so funny to see like left evangelicals, you know, like the 12 of them who exist, talking about this and saying, well, you know, gosh, we have to have this government spending so we can be in accord with the Bible. And then I ask, well, give me the biblical evidence then. Where is it? What verses are you even thinking of? What could you possibly be thinking of? They just assume that if something is called for, then that means the government should do it. They don't even realize they've made a logical leap there. Well, he goes on to say, Woods does not explain, for instance, why public charity is so corrosive to the family, but private charity is not. Now, I am virtually certain I have explained that numerous times. With private charity, for one thing, you have a completely different incentive structure. Public charity, so-called, gets a bigger budget the more people are on the rolls. And I've talked about that in, it must have been in The Church and the Market, and also in Rollback, my other book, Rollback, my 11th one. In that one, I also talk about this. But we have cases of people who work in the welfare bureaucracy saying that we can increase our caseload the more people we bring on, and that gives us a bigger budget, more power, and so on. So they have an interest in expanding dependency and in just, you know, basically just sending out checks in a bureaucratic way. Whereas private charity, they have to rely on contributions. How are you going to get contributions if you say, well, we really stink at this because now we have more and more people who are here who we have not helped to get on their feet and get jobs. Who's going to donate to that? They have to have as few people around as possible. They have to show that we've placed these people in jobs. We've got them in homes. We've got them on the right track. So the incentive is totally different. And secondly, because they don't have an endless spigot of money, they have to look into the real backgrounds of these families. They have to check up on them. They have to get to the root of what's happening. They don't just send them a check with their name written on them. They can't afford to do that. So they don't encourage the kind of self-defeating, destructive, perverse behavior that the government welfare state does. Although it should be said that early on, some of these charitable institutions did actually warn that even private charity could lead to bad consequences if they weren't really careful with how it was spent. Then he says, nor does Woods address the Pope's recent arguments that modern capitalism itself has a distorting effect on the human spirit. Welfare may erode a desire to pursue work, but the Pope is also arguing that materialism is eroding the desire for spiritual satisfaction. All right, well, I don't address that in the book, but I have addressed it in a YouTube video in which libertarians are accused of materialism and so on and so forth. In fact, let me make sure and write that down, YouTube on materialism. I'll put that at tomwoods.com/497. So I have addressed this, but let's go back to the McCloskey episode that we did some time ago and think back to what she said about the workers in Burgundy who would basically hibernate during the winter. They would lie down and huddle together and not get up because they couldn't afford the heat that they would need if they walked around, and they couldn't afford the food they would need to eat if they were up walking around. So they would just lie there in bed. Now, yeah, maybe they got a lot of spiritual satisfaction out of that. They certainly weren't cursed by the materialism of the modern Western world. Yep, that's true. They weren't. They didn't have to deal with that. But, you know, I would say that if you have material things and if you have a refrigerator and a stove and a warm house and you can get from place to place, would you say those people, like the ones I've just described who have those material things, are those people more or less likely to be able to pursue spiritual goods, to be able to pursue hobbies, to be able to pursue enriching things, to be able to pursue an interest in Renaissance art, for example, or to start a book club, or to learn another language, or whatever? I mean, the question answers itself. The more your material needs are satisfied, the more liberated you are to pursue non-material things. And then finally, Williams concludes, it's for these reasons that Woods and those who think like him remain outside the mainstream of Catholic thought. But his arguments offer a guide for Catholics who feel the need to reject Pope Francis's condemnation of the global economic order. All right, well, first of all, feel the need to reject sounds a little bit condescending, but I'm not supporting the global economic order. I mean, I love that our choices are Pope Francis or Paul Ryan. That's how the media wants it. There's the 3x5 card of conventional opinion right there on display. I'm against the global economic order because I'm against central banks. I believe central banks are immoral. And as a matter of fact, Guido Hulsman has a book called The Ethics of Money Production, which makes a moral argument against central banking and fiat money and so on. So I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/497. That's a wonderful book. Has Pope Francis in his entire life uttered one word about central banking? Of course not. Not a word. Nothing. Nothing. I don't think it's appeared in any encyclical. Nothing. Why? Why do we just assume that that's okay, that's benign, that's helping the poor? I condemn that. I condemn the global economic order, but for different reasons. Not for these ridiculous reasons that we don't have enough state-led development programs in the third world. How much damage do you want to do? That's already wrecked enough people's lives. Or the World Bank? I would shut that down. The International Monetary Fund? Don't need it. Fiat money, which is a central part of the global economic order, I think is a moral and economic catastrophe that makes people much more vulnerable in old age because they can't save money for retirement. Because if they do, their purchasing power will have eroded by then, even if you have so-called low inflation of 2% per year or whatever. You will have lost one-third or two-thirds of the value of your money by the time you retire. That's terrible and that's unjust. Not a word about that in the Pope Francis critique of the global economic order. So I'm very much against the global economic order, but because it doesn't respect freedom. Not that it respects it too much. Clearly, that's not our problem. All right. Well, anyway, this was not like a super disrespectful article. I don't want to give you the wrong idea. If you read it, it's linked at tomwoods.com/497. It's not terrible. I mean, I think it's condescending, and I think it is not entirely doing justice to my position, but I've been treated much worse than this in my life. I would be glad if all my opponents were like Chris Williams. Chris Matthews. Chris Williams is my audio guy. I'd be thrilled if all my opponents were like Chris Williams. He's like the greatest guy in the world. But no, Chris Matthews is the guy writing this article. So anyway, I'm glad I had a chance to sit down and do this. I got this all off my chest. As you've been able to hear over the course of this episode, you're going to get a treasure trove of goodies at tomwoods.com/497. So I do hope you'll check that out. Wait till you hear what's coming up tomorrow. But before I get to that, remember, over at libertyclassroom.com, I've got all this great stuff, 14 courses now. If you are one of those people who you bite your tongue half the time because you know you're right, but you just don't know quite what to say, or you're faced with arguments you don't know how to answer, or your family's on your case and they corner you and you don't know what to do, and you know, or you just wish you knew more, but I don't have the time, and I love this stuff, but I don't know where to start. That's why I have libertyclassroom.com. That's why I've got it. So check it out at libertyclassroom.com. You can learn from me and from people I trust on economics, history, political thought, logic, lots of great stuff there. We've got courses coming from Bob Murphy soon. We're going to learn more about economics. It's going to be fantastic. We got live sessions. You can ask me your questions in real time. You can ask them in the discussion forums. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Use coupon code SHOW in all caps for a discount for you good listeners. Then finally, let's talk about what's coming up tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be fun because I've had requests for this. Why don't I talk about the Article 5 Convention, especially for people who are not American citizens who may live around the world? Let me tell you, Article 5 of the Constitution mentions two ways to amend the Constitution. You can have a constitutional amendment passed by the Congress, and then it goes out to the states, or the states can meet together in convention and pass their own amendments. This way, they bypass Congress. Well, there are people who have called for that we need an Article 5 Convention. But there are people who have said this is dangerous. It could lead to a runaway convention, and who knows what crazy things they might do. Well, tomorrow we're going to debate this subject with two people who have very, very distinct and opposing positions on it. Kevin Gutzman, who is in favor of the Article 5 Convention, who is the author of James Madison and the Making of America, who's been a guest on this show, is going to argue in the affirmative that we should have such a convention. And Bill Jasper of the New American Magazine is going to argue in the negative. It's going to be a lot of fun. You are not going to want to miss this episode, so make sure and subscribe, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.